Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the White House visit of Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and speak with Pakistan expert Christine Fair, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She joins us to discuss the strained relations between the United States and Pakistan and concerns that America will abandon Pakistan after its withdrawal from Afghanistan. Then we'll examine the latest display of racist disrespect for the president that occurred in a recent White House meeting when a top House GOP leader told Obama to his face that, "I cannot even stand to look at you." Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington and author of Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America, joins us to discuss the disgusting and dangerous level of hatred in American politics. Then finally, we'll have an overview of the economy and an analysis of why the Republicans, having lost the fight over the shutdown and the debt ceiling, are dominating the national conversation over the size of government and the deficit, which a lot of Americans see as our biggest problem, even though it is demonstrably wrong. Justin Wolfers, a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan and co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity, joins us to discuss the Republicans' focus on deficits while ignoring the collapse of the middle class and the growing inequality as almost all of the economic gains go to the top 1%. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks, Chris. And the Prime Minister of Pakistan at a meeting at the White House, he had breakfast this morning with Vice President Biden. And I take it drones are very much on the agenda, but also economic assistance. The U.S. recently restored more than $1.6 billion in military and economic aid. And in September, the IMF approved a $6.64 billion extension of a loan to Pakistan. But just to start with the economy, Pakistan's economy, are these band-aids ever going to make any ultimate difference in the sense that the Sharif government appears unwilling or unable to take the hard steps and make the choices to structurally turn around the Pakistan economy?
I mean, the short answer is no. I mean, because there are so many fundamental problems with the economy. I mean, you could begin with the tax base, very low collection of income taxes, but perhaps even more pernicious than that is that Pakistani elites just refuse to tax themselves. I mean, believe it or not, they don't have an industrial or an agricultural tax. So what ends up happening is that they keep passing off taxation in the form of general sales tax, which is very regressive and hurts the poor. I mean, we could have discussions of this nature on virtually every aspect of Pakistan's fiscal policy or lack thereof.
So are we going to just be continually asked to apply Band-Aids here? Is that the future?
I mean, I suspect it is, because ultimately what the United States really cares about in the near term is getting out of Afghanistan. And this requires Pakistan's cooperation, of course, both with respect to getting the war material out of Afghanistan back through Pakistan on ships and back to their place of origination or their onward destination. But it also requires Pakistan's help to at least put some sort of a respectable finish on this war so that the Americans don't look totally disgraced. And so we're going to do in the near term whatever it takes to continue to buy Pakistan's cooperation. It's very much like a parking meter. You've got time as long as you keep putting money in. Over the long term, that is to say, beyond 2014 and beyond, Pakistan is going to continue bribing the international community, pointing out how dangerous it is, and to make sure that the international community doesn't simply wash its hands and turn away from Pakistan, or even worse, try to contain it or punish it through punitive sanction regimes for supporting terrorism under nuclear umbrella. It continues to invest in its nuclear program. It's very vocal about pursuing tactical nuclear weapons. It's very vocal about its efforts to combat India's so-called cold start strategy. So basically, Pakistan is going to continue to invest in its assets, which are absolutely hair-raising, and that which will allow it to continue to extract rents and compensation from the international community.
So, in other words, Pakistan is using the fact that they are the fastest-growing nuclear arsenal in the world. They've apparently surpassed the French in total numbers. They're, in effect, using their nuclear arsenal as a form of blackmail to extract aid on the basis of the general concern about the size of their arsenal, the instability of the country, and the possibility of a war with India?
Oh, absolutely. And I would further add, it's able to continue its policy of revisionism towards India because of this nuclear arsenal. And that is to say, Pakistan's completely free to deploy terrorist organizations to attack India, knowing full well that India is very constrained in its ability to respond militarily because of these nuclear weapons. It also forces the United States to intervene in any conflict cycle, which, you know, time and time again, the conflicts are started by Pakistan. So they're pretty much Pakistan's go-to strategy for international coercion as well as for bilateral coercion vis-a-vis India.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fares, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, the Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So I take it, though, that both Nawaz Sharif, the Prime Minister, who's meeting at the White House, and Pakistan's ambassador in Washington, they've all suggested that they want their concerns about the U.S. abandoning Pakistan after they withdraw from Afghanistan assuaged.
Oh, I am so sick of hearing this. I really am sick and tired of hearing it. Pakistan continues to you know, bang out this sorry tune on its kazoo, and it's absolutely exhausting. The United States and Pakistan, we are not spouses, we are not lovers, we are not in a pimp-prostitute relationship, as they like to say. We are countries that have very divergent strategic interests. The only reason Pakistan is important to the United States is because it is a menace to international security and to U.S. national security interests. The country that has the most say in whether or not the American public, as embodied by a Congress which is ever wary of Pakistan, the only country that can dictate the terms of this relationship in a positive way going forward is Pakistan. And that is, will Pakistan decide to give up jihad as a tool of foreign policy, which is enabled by its ever-expanding nuclear umbrella? Will Pakistan stop being a primary exporter of Islamist terrorism and quite frankly, remaining a concern of nuclear proliferation? Pakistan is not entitled to the American taxpayers' hard-earned dime. There's no reason why the middle-class Americans should be supporting the average Pakistani when Pakistani elites aren't supporting Pakistanis. So I, you know, whenever I hear this tire-old tune, I call the nonsense flag on it. They are not entitled to our continual support, particularly when, despite the $25-odd billion that we have given them since 9/11, they continue to take those funds, support the Taliban in Afghanistan, who are killing our troops. Now, if the American taxpayer doesn't understand the bloody math that undergirds this relationship, you know, I don't know what to say to them. I mean, I think the time to cut the Pakistanis off, it really came and went a long time ago.
Well, I imagine the U.S. military know this all too well, since they, I don't know what percentage of the casualties come from Pakistan, in the sense that shortly after 9/11, the first UN intervention, the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, effectively routed the Taliban with a very small boots on the ground footprint, and they were basically driven out almost to extinction. And it looks as though Pakistan brought them back, and they've sheltered them, they've supplied them, all of the IEDs that have killed Americans and blown their limbs off. The ANFO comes from Pakistan. I mean, I could go on. There's a litany.
Yep.
So what are they saying? I mean, you know, they've been killing our guys in the sense that they, you know, they've been duplicitous in the worst possible way, and yet they're still trying to extract concessions.
Well, I mean, you said it as well as I can say it. I mean, I, as a taxpayer and as an analyst of the region since 1991, I just find myself exhausted with American policy towards the region. We continue to learn no lessons from this. You know, you and I have been talking about this for years, Ian. I mean, from beginning with the folly of the surge. I mean, I remember having this very discussion with you. And, you know, I said at the time, the surge is ridiculous because what the surge is going to do is increase our dependence upon Pakistan to continue to supply this war when the reason why we can't win this war is in good measure because of Pakistan. And so the problem with American policy from the beginning is that they chose to prosecute a war, and they did choose it. We did have other options available to us after 9/11, but we chose to prosecute a war without reliable allies. Now, you know, this raises, well, what other countries in the region could have we worked with? And I always remind people of Iran. Right after 9/11, Iran was incredibly helpful. The Bonn conference in which Afghanistan's interim constitution was drafted, it was Iran that mentioned democracy. It was Iran that pointed out that democracy wasn't in that constitution. It was Iran that pointed out that both the war on drugs and the war on terror should be reaffirmed in the interim constitution. And of course, what the George Bush administration did was, you know, thanked Iran by including it in the Axis of Evil. We would be in such a different place if we could have found a way to work with Iran instead of basically strapping ourselves to this bomb called Pakistan. But that's what we did instead. We strapped ourselves to this explosive, unreliable country that is taking as much as it can while giving as little as it has to.
Well, and of course, as we withdraw, we pay an enormous bribe or tax or whatever you want to call it to get equipped. to get equipment into Afghanistan via Pakistan. And now, in order to get it out, we have to pay this huge bribe as well. And the Iranians built a road from the Indian Ocean all the way up to Afghanistan, which would be the perfect route. But, you know, we can't talk.
They actually built that road and rail link. So basically, you've got this port in Chabahar that's been developed with Indian assistance. With Indian assistance, they built the rail and road link that connects basically traffic from Chabahar up to the Afghan border, and then a continuing road that then hooks it up and onto the ring road. Now, you know, Americans will howl and squeal at the suggestion that we could have done this through Iran, and I tell them, you know, they can pretty much shove it because Iran only aspires to be the nuclear proliferator and supporter of terrorism that Pakistan is. Iran has done nothing that Pakistan hasn't done orders of magnitude more, and yet we have found a way of shoving $25 billion down the throat of Pakistan while absolutely having no significant backup plan. There was a northern distribution route, but even at its peak, it could carry no more than about one-fifth maximum of the logistic requirement to support the war in Afghanistan. And people forget that because of basically Russian chicanery, we were never allowed to move lethal equipment through the northern distribution route. And, of course, you know, we're fighting a war, right? So that does require us to move lethal things into theater. It's hard to not just be it's hard 12 years into this to be anything less but cynical to such an extreme.
Well, also, in contrast to shoveling money at Pakistan and turning our back on Iran, who's been helpful, we're sanctioning Iran over a nuclear program that they don't have a bomb, where the Pakistanis do, and they may want a nuclear capability, but they don't appear to want a bomb. So that's a peculiar double standard as well.
No, I mean, like I said, I mean, Ian, you and I—actually, you and I met right after this whole war on terror began. And, I mean, this—from the beginning, we had choices. we like to tell ourselves that we didn't. The fact is, American leadership decided to do exactly what you said, which was to basically work with this country that was under, by the way, it was also under the dictatorship, although a dictatorship that was palatable to Washington at the time. It was basically an autocracy run by a general that had seized power in a coup, which is, of course, extra-constitutional. In fact, he committed two acts of treason. It is a well-known proliferator. In fact, that's how Iran got its nuclear technology from Pakistan. And you know, here we were trying to find every possible way to work with Pakistan while during the exact same period trying to find ways of alienating Iran. And I'll tell you what's so frustrating about that, not just from the logistical point of view, but also from the point of view of strategy. Whether Americans want to hear it or not, the Iranians have more in common with us in terms of the outcome that is preferable in Afghanistan than Pakistan. And that's just the way it is. The Iranians were not fans of the Taliban. The Iranians do not want the Taliban back in power if they can avoid it. And in fact, to be completely blunt, though Iran's policies are deeply flawed, its democracy is deeply flawed, in some significant way, the Iranian democracy is much more practiced than the Pakistani democracy. And so, you know, there's going to be a future when Iran is no longer controlled by this current unpalatable regime. And, you know, the Iran that emerges, I think, is going to be much more in a line with our interests than, say, Pakistan. And we were just never able to see that throughout the entire duration of what is now the longest war in American history.
So, Christopher, let's turn to the drone issue, which apparently, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif said on Tuesday that the drone strikes deeply disturb and agitate the Pakistani people, and it's an issue of a major irritant in relations with the U.S. What's your take on that?
Well, okay, so my take on this is two things. I mean, yes, it's true that many Pakistanis are deeply outraged by the drone program, but it is also true that that outrage is absolutely fanned by an elaborate misinformation machine run by the Pakistan military and its PR arm, the IFPR, as well as the media wing of the ISI. Fact. The Pakistanis own the airspace. Fact. They have to deconflict the airspace to accommodate the operation of drones in the various flight boxes to which they are constrained. If you look at a map, I mean, this is very much an airspace through which civilian aircraft would otherwise be traveling. So we can't deconflict Pakistani airspace, right? The drones, they fly at different altitudes, some of which are the same altitude as a civilian aircraft. The Pakistanis have to deconflict that airspace, otherwise there would be accidents all over the place. Fact, the Pakistanis are providing intelligence to enable these drone strikes, which is why they have been so effective. It's also a fact that we are killing Pakistan's terrorists, perhaps more so than we're killing terrorists that generally affect our interests. The reason being, we've simply depleted the high-level al-Qaeda target set. And so we're basically engaging in what is widely known in D.C. as goodwill kills. In other words, we're killing Pakistan's terrorists so that we can continue to operate drone strikes to take out those that are of interest to us. And also, we don't have an interest in Islamist terrorists, you know, rampaging across Pakistan. So, you know, what I find so exhausting are the Ben Emersons howling on about how the drones violate Pakistan's sovereignty and how he will drone on, if you will, about how the parliament has declared this to be a violation of Pakistan's sovereignty. Well, you know, Ben Emerson should clue up. The Pakistan parliament does not control Pakistan's foreign policy. It does not control Pakistan's national security policy. The army controls that. And so when he wants to talk about violation of Pakistan's sovereignty, he needs to take this argument to Pakistan's ISI and to the army headquarters, because that's where this policy is being made. When Amnesty International comes out and lambasts the Americans for not being forthcoming about who we're killing in a covert program, which is, you know, visible that Amnesty would even make such a demand, knowing full well that covert programs don't typically get a point-by-point readout on the public, you know, on the local news channel. It's important to note that at least part of the reason why this program is still covert is that the Pakistanis don't want their hand in this to be revealed. It would be incredibly embarrassing for Pakistanis to know how involved their government is in these drone strikes. That's why this program remains covert, whereas Obama said that other elements of the drone program would be handed over to the DOD and could at least then be clandestine, which is has a less rigorous disclosure policy than things that are covert. So mm-hmm. he can howl and scream all he wants. The fact remains that we know from WikiLeaks that Pakistan's apex political leadership prior to his assuming power agreed to this. He also knows that his army calls the shots, not him. And I think the interesting thing about Nawaz Sharif coming here and talking about drones, in some sense, he feeds right into the hands of the army because he's not going to stop the drones. The drones are going to stop when American interests and Pakistan Army's interests are served. He can howl and scream all he wants about drones. It's not going to change policy, and he knows it. He simply looks as ineffective as the Pakistan Army thinks he is.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute here, I want to get your take on the proliferation of conspiracy theories in Pakistan, how much they affect the bilateral relations. Recently, the vice chancellor of Pakistan's largest university came up with a book that says that the British and American governments are controlled by a high cabal which manipulates each of us by putting microchips in our brains.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you need any comment from me to underscore how absolutely asinine such a supposition is. But look, let's take the Malala. I mean, I think anyone watching the Malala episode, you know, which is the young girl that was shot by the Taliban, the conspiracy theories that have circulated about her are equally ignominious. The conventional wisdom there is that obviously the Taliban could not have shot her because if the Taliban shot her, she would have been dead. Therefore, the CIA must have shot her so that they could orchestrate this entire thing to make Pakistan look bad. I mean, come on. And here's the thing that will just completely blow your mind away. So many Pakistanis believe this rubbish. That's the thing. You know, it's so hard, I think, for folks like myself to reconcile, is that here's a country that has a very well-educated elite, a very wealthy elite. It has nuclear weapons. It has the fifth largest stockpile in the world. And yet, at the same time, it's a country that subscribes to this nonsense. Now, I will point out that very similar parallels can be made about Americans. You know, our ignorance is completely inversely related to our national power. So I think maybe Pakistanis and Americans have more in common than either would like to believe.
Well, Chris Farah, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Have a fabulous day.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're looking into a top House GOP leader's insult to the president, where he said to his face, "I cannot even stand to look at you."
What is, and you say, oh my God, am I here all alone? But something is happening and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? You hand in your ticket.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington, and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
I appreciate the invitation, Ian.
And there's obviously been a persistent and poisonous disrespect for President Obama since he took office, coming from the right in this country, and particularly the Tea Party right. But it seems that they have even broken their own record for disrespect and vitriol. Apparently, according to Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin, a House Republican leader, senior top House Republican leader, at meetings over the government shutdown with President Obama in the White House, told the president to his face, "I cannot even stand to look at you." Now, I cannot believe that that happened, and I guess at some point or other we'll get to the bottom of it, but are you surprised?
I'd be surprised if it were not a Tea Party Republican, but I'm going to assume that it was a Tea Party Republican who said this. Is there a record of who actually said this?
No. So far, we only have Dick Durbin's word for it, and the House Republican leaders haven't responded to press requests. So that's where we stand. But we know that Obama met with congressional leaders from both parties and a delegation of House Republicans and House Democrats and Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans all in separate meetings. So I assume that given the incendiary nature of what Durbin has – he actually posted on his Facebook page on Sunday that – I can actually read you the quote if you want. "Many Republicans searching for something to say in defense of the disastrous shutdown strategy will say President Obama just doesn't try hard enough to communicate with Republicans. What are the chances of an honest conversation with someone who has just said something so disrespectful?" And then, you know, explains what that "I cannot even stand to look at you," which is what was said to Obama's face. So there you have it. That's all that I know at the moment.
Okay. I would venture a guess that it would be one of these Tea Party-affiliated Republicans, what we call in the book reactionary conservatives. And what that is a reactionary conservative departs from more mainstream traditional conservatives in many different ways. One way is that conservatives don't necessarily embrace change, right? But they realize change or social change is necessary in order to preserve the stability of society. Otherwise, you have what's called revolutionary change, right? Well, these reactionary conservatives don't want change of any kind. They actually want to go back in time to a time during which, you know, people of color, quote unquote, knew their respective places in American society, but moreover, you know, where women, you know, were supposed to be in the kitchen and homosexuals weren't to be seen nor heard from, right? That's when they say we want to take our country back, they're talking about taking it back in time in addition to taking it back for, quote unquote, real Americans who tend to be white, mainly male, middle class, middle aged, Protestant, and straight. If you think about the archetypical American, right, from the time this country was founded to now, that's what they would look like. And anybody that deviates from that quote unquote norm is not considered a real American, and obviously President Obama fits that.
Well, I actually got some feedback from listeners during the coverage of the shutdown and the threat to default on the debt, whereas invariably in the press, people referred to the House Republican Tea Party caucus as radicals. And listeners wrote into me saying, radical is a dignified term. Thomas Jefferson and Tom Paine were radicals.
Right.
use the word reactionary. So you're reinforcing that, I guess, by describing these people as reactionaries.
Yes, that's precisely who they are. They're reacting to these people that are in this demographic that I just mentioned, who tend to be really strong supporters of the Tea Party. Not everybody, but if you look at it probabilistically, most folks that are either in the Tea Party or identify with it are white, 90%, male, 57%, middle class, you know, 20% of them have an income of at least $100,000 or above, and 26% of them, you know, have at least a college degree, middle-aged, about 67%, two-thirds of them are 45 years old and older, straight, we didn't ask that question on a survey, right, and Protestant, right? But these are even evangelicals. 53% are born-again Christians. So that's the demographic we're talking about, right? And these are the people that these congressional representatives that are affiliated with the Tea Party represent. These are the reactionaries, right? They're reacting against this perceived change, right, that Obama represents. It's not about Obama qua Obama. It's about what he represents symbolically. First of all, he's the president, right? And the president is, you know, the highest official in the land, right? The president is the face of the country, which these people can't get over, right? The president, with Obama in office, and the president is also the head of government. So when taxes are going up, right, it's not just government that has his hand in your pocket. It's this black man who has his hand in my pocket.
Again, I'm speaking with Chris Parker, professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington, and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. So this is a president, though, Chris, who won handily in the last election. And interestingly enough, shortly after the stinging defeat, the Republicans met in January at a retreat in Williamsburg and drafted a policy with Boehner, you know, in attendance, that mostly driven by the Tea Party caucus, who basically came up with a strategy of not to negotiate with the Senate Democrats and not to negotiate with the White House. And that sort of led directly to the shutdown strategy and the default strategy, which is blown up in their face. But curiously enough, Ted Cruz, the main architect of this failed strategy, just returned to Texas as a conquering hero.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, you got a lot of folks in Texas that identify with the Tea Party, right? So that comes as no surprise to me. But to be fair, there are several Texans, right, that don't identify with that, right? And as the browner Texas gets, the less people are going to identify with that, with the Tea Party faction in Congress, right, or with that sort of Tea Party mentality or ideology. But for the people that are voting in Texas, right, I mean, I think I saw it someplace that the King Street Tea Partiers, they threw a little welcome home party for him, at which at least 600 people were in attendance. So it was something like that, right? And of course, they represent a much larger swath of people who identify with the Tea Party in Texas. But I would say that there's a sizable faction of people who don't necessarily identify with the Tea Party. But here's the point, Ian. People who identify with the Tea Party tend to be far more politically engaged and politically aware than anybody else, right? So they're going to show up for him, right? It's just like, it's that simple.
So are we dealing here then with the sort of psychological factor that the squeaky wheel gets the grease? In other words, people who are outrageous in this culture, like the Kardashians, you know, people, I mean, they get attention. They certainly don't deserve it, but they get it. I mean, Kim Kardashian got famous for a sex tape, you know. So is that what's happening here, that, you know, as long as you just are outrageous and say terrible things, you'll get media attention, and that the silent majority are basically decent, but the problem is they're silent?
Yeah, I mean, one can make that argument, but actually I want to reframe what you just said as far as the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And what I mean by that is that I think most of these people, with the exception of maybe like Louis Gohmert or some of these other you know, people who aren't too bright, that represent, you know, Tea Party supporters, most of these folks are really smart and they know better, right? But because they know, right, that these Tea Party identifiers that are in a mass public pay more attention to politics, right, and they tend to give more money and they tend to volunteer, right, and they tend to vote at higher rates than other conservatives, they have to make a good show of it, right? They really have to do that. So in that way, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I want to reframe it such that the squeaky wheel are the constituents out there that these folks in Congress represent. They know they're noisy, but in addition to the noise, they're also very, very politically engaged, and votes and money win elections.
Well, just in closing then, Chris Parker, is there a possibility that somebody in this country is going to stand up and demand a timeout and a moment of reflection as where we stand as a culture in terms of the degradation of our political discourse?
You know, I think as long as President Obama is in office, I think that we will continue to see this sort of vitriolic discourse that's aimed at him. Right, because these people are not dealing with rational faculties. They're really not. See, that presumes rationality. When people say that, you know, the Republican Party, you know, the adults like Boehner, you know, Boehner gave them enough rope to hang themselves, McConnell gave them enough rope to hang themselves, and they should feel chastened. Well, that presumes that there's an air of rationality, that they're dealing with rational thought. But what research has shown, in fact, what social science has shown, is that when conservatives are scared, rationality has no place in their decision calculus. So as long as Obama is here to scare them in their perception, make them anxious, make them fearful, make them angry, nothing's going to change. Nothing is going to change.
Well, Chris Parker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're very welcome, Ian. And take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington, and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. His latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an overview of the economy and analysis of why a lot of Americans still see the deficit as our biggest problem.
Bruce Brother!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
A mark, a yen,
a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Justin Wolfers, a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan and co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity and a senior scientist for the Gallup Organization. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Wolfers.
A pleasure to be back.
And it seems a paradox to me that conservative Republicans have lost the fight over the shutdown and the debt ceiling, and yet they still appear to dominate the national debate over what the greatest priority and problem that the nation faces, and that is, according to them, the size of government and the budget deficits. So how could this be so?
So I think we want to separate two issues. One, was it a good idea to shut down the federal government and to threaten to default on the debt ceiling? I think unequivocally, no, it wasn't. And then two, what did they get out of it? And it looks like they got nothing out of that, but realized the deal that got done cements in place all of the cuts to government spending that that were put in place under the Budget Control Act, or alternatively, what's known as sequester. So the government is smaller as a result, and you might have thought that that Obama would try and undo some of the sequester, and he hasn't. So there's some sense in which the tactics and the amount of political capital involved were not a great idea, but the ultimate outcome is actually one that's quite conservative.
So I suppose in the sense that over the next few months we'll be having a debate over whether to cut the federal budget deficit by cutting future entitlement spending and closing some tax loopholes, or alternatively going back to the sequester. So that's not particularly a good choice.
Right. If you're a liberal who wanted to see Obama given the space to implement his agenda, that's definitely not happening right now.
But to the broader point I made, do you agree, though, that it seems that the underlying justification for those that in the constituencies that supported the Tea Party's actions in the shutdown, people like Senator Coburn and others, seem to honestly believe that the federal budget deficit is the greatest problem and the size of government is the greatest problem we face, and that they're willing in almost a religious way to bring the temple down in order to purify us and get us onto the right path? So why does that notion, which I think is demonstrably wrong, why does it appear to dominate the debate?
I think you want to start by separating out a few issues. So you confounded two in your question that I think get confounded too often. You said that Tea Party types believe that the greatest problem is the budget deficit and the size of government. They're actually two very distinct things. And my guess is when we balance the budget, there will still be just as much pressure from the Tea Party types to continue to cut government spending. So I think that there's a lot of rhetoric used around the budget deficit, which, you know, families sort of understand that. We all have our own deficits, which are actually being used instead to try and cut back on the size of government. So to be honest, I don't think that there's a great deal of fervor on either side of politics around the budget deficit right now. Equally, I don't think there's any great need to. One of the great surprises for those of us who look at data, the thing that surprises most people is, first of all, the U.S. budget deficit is improving tremendously right now. We still have a deficit, but it's just about halved over the past few years. And secondly, the deficit's at a level right now that the Congressional Budget Office, an independent outfit, projects that the debt-to-GDP ratio is actually going to stabilize over the next few years. So maybe there's not really such a problem there, at least not in the short run.
Well, I think that's the point I was trying to make, is that it's really not a problem, but it still appears to be the motivation for the Republican economic agenda. You know, the deficits now seems to be dropping at a record rate, and it's down to the same share of the economy as averaged over the last 30 years. So you think you could put that one to bed. I guess what I'm suggesting here is that my feeling is that as long as we're talking about the deficit and the size of government, we're not talking about the decline of the middle class and the growing disparity in wealth in this country, where all the economic gains are going to the top.
Right. You know, I completely agree with that. And I think the point I was trying to make is I don't actually believe that hysteria over the budget is actually what's motivating anyone here. I think the issue is being used, but it's being used as a way of instead implementing an agenda that's actually about reducing the size of government. So I do wish the debate were, frankly, just more honest around that. We don't have a budget deficit problem. We do have an ongoing debate about the role of government, and I wish we'd separate those arguments, and we can and we should. I think you're right. You know, if you counted the number of headlines in the newspaper, we probably have more headlines around issues of the budget deficit than the issues of the middle class. But equally, you know, some of that's coming out of the fact that the U.S. has a system with a tremendous number of checks and balances. And so certainly you've got a president in the White House who has a liberal agenda, but there's nothing that he can get through Congress. And so things are basically stalled. There's not an interesting conversation really to be had around that, and there doesn't seem to be much hope of moving Congress or the median congressman across to a position where much of that agenda could get passed.
And again, I'm speaking with Justin Wolfers, who's a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan and co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity and a senior scientist for the Gallup Organization. But one thing that seems to be clear, at least to me, and it's certainly coming out of the glitches to do with the healthcare.gov website and its woes, which of course is the portal for the launching of the Affordable Care Act. What we're learning now is, of course, that the problems from these private government contractors, and we learned earlier from the Edward Snowden affair of how much the intelligence budget now has been privatized with private contractors who make something like 98% of their money from the federal, from our tax dollars, and yet are private entities. And the same, of course, is true from our earlier experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan with the Halliburtons of this world. So when you talk about the size of government, it would seem to me that we're, again, missing the point here, that government, the size of government's been steadily reduced and the privatization movement appears to be unstoppable.
I think the healthcare.gov debacle has lessons for both sides. So if Amazon had been tasked with setting this up, there's no way they would have missed the deadline. It would be a beautiful, shiny website, and it would probably also convince me to buy a couple of books I didn't need to buy at the same time. You know, we see incredibly successful private sector organizations taking on incredibly complex computing challenges, and Amazon is enormously more complex than healthcare.gov. On the flip side, a different argument, and one I have a lot of sympathy for as well, is federal government is one of, or perhaps the major consumer of the complex technical computing requirements that come with having to build things that can deal with hundreds of millions of people. And instead of building up that capacity internally, they have gone out to the system of bringing in outside contractors. And I think if they developed the expertise internally, it would be possible for Amazon to, for the federal government to be the Amazon of big data. They are one of the biggest big data organizations in the world. So we're in this terrible halfway house when we're using outside contractors, and the contractors aren't as good as Amazon would be, and maybe not as good as the expertise we could develop in-house. The deeper problem, I really think, is when you talk to people in Washington about this, is that the way we go about doing procurement is fundamentally broken. So we more or less hire a bunch of clowns at too high of a price to implement these things. And they do a bad job and it's expensive. And that's exactly what healthcare.gov has shown. My guess and my bet, though, is the firms that failed so badly this time are still going to win a bunch of future government contracts. And that is a big problem, and it's something we should try and fix.
And the biggest contractor on healthcare.gov, the Canadian company CGI, they came in with an initial bid of $94 million. They've now over doubled that, and they have a ceiling of $300 million. So that seems to be systemic, isn't it, where you get a government contract and then you can literally write your own ticket?
Well, I fear you're slightly overstating the case in saying literally write your own ticket. You know, there's contracting problems with all organizations. And, you know, Mike Bloomberg had a famous example in New York where he's trying to overhaul their payroll systems and sunk millions of the city's dollars into it and failed. But also, if you've worked for any large organization, you'll see large companies doing the same thing sometimes. There are problems with this, and one needs to be savvy about how one writes contracts and how one chooses contractors. And part of the problem is every time we figure out that procurement is broken, Congress decides to fix it by passing even more laws and more rules. And the more rule-bound the whole thing becomes, the less flexibility we have for going out and actually just finding the right darn contractor at the right price.
So turning to the latest news, Justin Wolfer, about the economy coming from the Labor Department, reporting Tuesday that only 148,000 jobs were created in September, down from an average of 207,000 new jobs a month in the first quarter of the year. What do you make of that?
So the glass half full version of this is our economic recovery just keeps on keeping on. And it's kept on keeping on over the past 3 or 4 years, despite all manner of shocks that have come at it from Europe, from Japan, some self-inflicted wounds from Congress and so on, and so it's remarkably resilient. And creating jobs at around 150,000 a month is awfully close to 200,000 a month, and we shouldn't overinterpret. The glass half empty view is it looks like over the past few months jobs growth has been slowing. It was already too slow to heal the damage done by the Great Recession quickly enough. And these were data from the period just before the government shutdown and the debt ceiling debacle, which we know had a huge effect on consumer confidence. So it is quite worrying to see the economy sort of just above stall speed, just as we're starting to hit a speed bump. I'm not as confident as I would otherwise be that we come out of this still moving along at a good clip.
And of course, the official unemployment rate of 7.2% reflects only those who are still looking for work. And the workforce today is, when Obama first took office, today's unemployment rate, you know, if you relate it to that, today's unemployment rate would be at 10.8%. So how is this going to affect the Fed in terms of their scaling back their expectations of growth?
Yeah, so you've hit on actually quite a complex point. So it is true that there are fewer people in the workforce today than there were 4 years ago. One interpretation that people are drawn to and the one that you used was, well, they're all just not looking for work, but they would be if there was jobs around. They're all discouraged workers. That's often the case. I'm not sure that's happening this time. A different interpretation is, in fact, what's happening right now is a longer-term demographic shift. The baby boomers are aging. They're hitting retirement age. And so what this means is a lot more of our adults are actually dropping out of the workforce, not because they're forced to by the recession, but because they're hitting that time of their life when they no longer want to be working. And that then, you know, if this is the interpretation, it gives a very, very different view about the state of the labor market. And it looks to me that there's actually some truth to that second view as well. So I don't think we need to tell stories about why 7.2% understates the unemployment rate. I instead emphasize that just on its own, 7.2% is an incredibly high unemployment rate. There are 11 million Americans out of work. There's a lot of things we could have them doing, and the Fed could and should be very active about trying to get those people back to work.
But isn't it also true, though, that those that have gone back to work, particularly since the crash of 2008, many have gone back into service jobs that pay less, and they certainly pay less than manufacturing jobs. And the manufacturing sector, even though politicians often tell us we should, you know, restore our manufacturing base, my understanding is what we've done to restore our manufacturing base is largely to employ robots as opposed to people.
So I hear this a lot, this claim that the recovery has been generating low-quality jobs. And when I ask people for evidence on this, they sort of start to go quiet. And it turns out that it is generally true that in the early stages of recovery, employment in the low end of the income, the skill distribution starts to pick up before the high end. In some sense, we should be happy about that. They're the folks we really need to get back to work before their skills really depreciate. So, you know, average wages have continued to grow too slowly, but they've continued to grow. So I don't buy the view that we've just been creating low-quality jobs through the recovery. It just doesn't cohere with the data that I'm seeing. And then the second thing I'd say is I've always been confused and a little surprised by the romanticism with which both American political leaders and often the American left hold manufacturing and manufacturing jobs. I've been in factories. They don't seem particularly pleasant. I think the important thing is to get people back to work, and whether we've got them back to work in a noisy factory or back to work in an office or in a retail environment, I'm not sure why it is that we want to romanticize the factory.
So, well, I'm glad we're having this conversation because you are certainly clarifying a lot for me here. So let's turn to what most people are seeing as good news. And you wrote a piece recently, Yellen is the right choice for Fed chair. Is it? I mean, my understanding is that she has basically voted along with a minority on the Fed board in terms of the quantitative easing, to try and sort of divert some of that money towards community banks and underwater household mortgages and stuff. Is that true, and is that an indication that she'll be less concerned with inflation and more concerned with job growth?
So let me start with the premise again. In my memory, Janet Yellen has never dissented from the majority view on the when at the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been a few times when inflation nutters have been worried that the Fed was too easy with monetary policy, and they've said they were against it, but not Janet Yellen. Actually, the first thing I'd say about Janet Yellen is she will be the single most qualified person ever appointed as Federal Reserve Chair. That's really important to say because it's also an historic occasion, where she's also going to be the first woman who's appointed. But she's just a fantastic economist. It is true that she is deeply concerned about unemployment, and I think of that as being a very good thing. She's also a central banker, though. She's also concerned about inflation. I think it's less useful. The media often talks about you're either a dove, which means you care a lot about unemployment, not much about inflation, or you're a hawk. You care a lot about inflation, but not about unemployment. I think it's less useful to ask whether Yellen is a dove or a hawk. Usually people say she's a dove. Then to say, has she been right? And for the past 4 years, she's been one of the most strident voices suggesting the Fed needs to do more. It needs to be more active trying to get people back to work through monetary expansion. Those on the other side have said, yes, but if we do that, it will cause inflation. It's been crystal clear she's been right at every step. The inflation that those who were against her had been forecasting hasn't materialized. And 4 years after the Great Recession, 5 years after the Great Recession, I should say, unemployment still remains unconscionably high. So if we had been following the monetary policy she suggested, I think it's completely fair to say that millions more would be back at work today, and we wouldn't have any. And this comes even without any inflation pressures having arisen. So the point is, she's basically just been right.
But in terms of the dichotomy between hawks and doves in economics, I understand that there's also another dichotomy, and that is originally economics was taught in much more in a social and humane context, and that in many ways there's been a new school, if you will, that's more devoted to numbers crunching than to the human impact of economics. So if that's a correct dichotomy, would she stand with the more humanistic approach as opposed to the more numbers crunching approach?
Janet is a very fine economist, which means that she absolutely knows how to crunch a number or write down a theoretical model or any of the rest of it, as well as the rest of us do. But she's a deeply humane person. She understands that beneath those numbers are real people living real lives, and that things like an unemployment rate are not abstract. They're actually a way of counting up misery that's out there in our society. And, I think she then understands that, you know, with her new position comes enormous responsibility. She believes that the Fed can do something to alleviate some of that suffering, and I think she's going to do so.
Well, Justin Wolfers, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
A pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Justin Wolfers, who's a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan and co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity and a senior scientist for the Gallup Organization. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was